Had enough of me? I've had enough, and I can sleep in the bed place. Please, that's quite all right. How generous you are, he said. You Jews. So scared of us all, you have to placate us. If you don't want the bed, don't have it. Oh, petit amande. I blew out the flame and drank the hot vodka, which burnt my lips. We had been cautious in kissing. A nice change after Georges, who was liable to knock out your teeth. Stefan shrugged. He said the funny little nonsense phrase again. Ne que vont désir. What? He replied in English now, primly. I don't want that myself. I must have misheard the French, or else he misused the language, saying exactly what he did not mean at all. I'm tired, I said. But you'd give me the bed. Ah, mon monstre. I threw a flare of money on the table, enough for the spirit of eating and for him too if he wanted. I left the dining car and went back to my berth, where I shut, locked, and bolted the door. But I knew when he came and politely knocked, I would have to let him in, or at least reason with him. The colossal drinking had sobered me, and I wondered if he would now want to slit my throat or scar my face, drinking my blood, then robbing me of anything useful. Georges had spent most of our last days warning me about such people, shades of Anna in her schoolmarmish mode. Once he had tied me up and thrashed me with a piece of rope, but Georges didn't have much stamina. His arms soon ached, and I wasn't badly hurt. Then he wept at his weakness, his inability to punish me. Even the struggle on the stairs had only harmed my watch. No one knocked. It was 2 or 3 in the morning. I rode restlessly about on the ruined bed, smelling Stefan's expensive cologne and spent, healthy spunk. He had left behind a composite aura of something dangerous, wholesome yet metallic, clean yet impure. I wished he would come back, and dreaded him. Sleep came, in small, unnourishing slices, and I woke fully with a steely dawn. The blind was up, and birds, flying before the sun, threw forward their shadows into the carriage so they seemed to fly straight in and through the wall. As the train moves, so do the sun, moon, and stars. Everything moves, even the heart, unavoidable. But the train wasn't moving. It was static. My bones had so recorded its rumble and jangle, they played it still. Behind my shut lids, everything sped forward, but no longer. Some station had occurred again. More cows and pigs and bonfires and grandmothers. Yet even after I'd got up, washed and shaved, dressed myself, the train sat still where it was. The steward rapped and called, "Monsieur, monsieur! We are broken up." I flung wide the door in alarm. An accident? No, no. Snowbank. Before train, do you see? I said that I did. When he was gone, I put on my greatcoat and went out into the corridor, where the door had been left partly open. It was now fearfully cold. I mean, it made you afraid. You couldn't think what to do with it. I got out of the train and slid down into a mound of snow to my knees. On all sides was the nothingness God had lost interest in. Here and there black figures trudged up and down, 2 or 3 with primitive lighted torches whose purpose I couldn't guess. The train was so black and large it plainly had no place there. You could see this now. Reality must suffer a fatal inanition when plunged among the utterly unreal. Up ahead a snowslip could be on the line, but that was merely inevitable. It might have dropped straight from the unpainted and undecorated sky. Here there was not even a forest to be seen, let alone a station, a village, a shed. The birds had passed over, but we were immaterial to them. With a meaty grunt, the chocolate German thumped into the snow beside me. His basket was empty, and his brawn-like mottled face was greasy with desolation. "We shall be here 1 week," he announced. "Indeed. Last time it is 1 week. This time will be 1 week." "Really?" "All chocolate sold," he told me with a sinister pride. "They buy it all. Food will run out. and no wood for the stoves. Already all vodka is drunk. Oh, yes, I was quite scared, but more of its idea than because I believed it. Then he lurched malevolently at me, and I trod quickly back to avoid him. He said,
"You had him."
I turned away. The chocolate German pawed my shoulder.
"Let go." "You had him. We all have had him. He has gone through train like rodent. Even I had him. Never before, I swear. Only woman. Against the wall of a barn in a station yesterday."
"What are you talking about?" The chocolate German took no notice.
"He half says he will do it. Makes a list, ticks it off. The first night, before you get on. Back then, all of us. The peasant rubbish, too. Yes, yes, he had them. Last night, they lined up for it. I sold them chocolate as they waited. Their woman went to the other end of the carriage not to see. And now he's done. The train has stopped."
I lit a cigarette. I was in the land of storytellers. Even Georges had story told me that. Leaving the chocolate German where he had sunk in the snow, I walked down the line, passing the medieval men with torches. In the fireman's cabin was a hell of flame light, but no driver. The enormous muzzle of the train faced out across the waste, up to its stack against a whiteness like a tumbled hill. Faintly, I heard wolves howling over the snow. I thought to myself I had probably actually eaten enough, and drunk it, too, to last me a week. That snow could be sucked for fluid, that the German lied about the wood stores on the train. When I had got back on, I met the steward in the corridor.
"No cause for concern," he said, parrot-fashion bitterly.
"No, of course," I answered like a good child. In the dining car, the spirit of eating stood in a black fur coat that swept the ground, directing her uniformed slaves. Seeing me, she came up and said,
"We will not starve."
"No, madame." There were already rolls and butter laid. The samovar smoked among its tumblers of jam and cinnamon. The train, now that the doors had been closed again, was reasonably warm as it had ever been. As I began my breakfast, I heard the shovel start work up the line, but no one else entered the dining car. Presently, the spirit of eating again rolled up to me. She paused a moment, looking with her stony, sibilly eyes. Then she said in her own odd French, "He would not wait. He went out and went alone."
"Who, madame?"
"Your friend." "I haven't a friend in the world, madame." "The blonde monsieur," she said.
"Are you saying," I asked,
"he left the train to walk?"
"Yes, monsieur."
Oh, I was supposed to widen my eyes and press her for more. How was it possible? Wasn't it unwise? Was he insane? I let her fill my cup with fur black tea, and only said, "Then I expect he'll make the wolves wait their turn."
The X's Are Not Kisses by Tanith Lee and Esther Garber. After Jadis had left, Emily decided to clean the flat, very thoroughly. What had once been called a spring clean. She began with the small bathroom, which was usually done once a week in any case, and went on to overhaul the kitchen area, scouring the stove, removing everything from the cupboards, washing and burnishing glasses. She went over the tiles with something supposedly miraculous she had seen in a TV advert, but the result was disappointing. Nevertheless, it produced a lovely smell. Following this, Emily spent the weekend working on the large main room. She cleaned the long windows and the wide mirrors, shampooed the carpet, dusted down the curtains with an appliance on the Hoover she had never used before. She polished the tables and brushed the ornaments with a soft brush meant for a camera lens. Outside the flat it was indeed spring, and Emily bought a dwarfed laurel, and 2 young bay trees. Then she stood outside the tiny bedroom that Jadis had always used as her office and chamber of practice. Emily stood with her flaxen head on one side, wondering. To clean or not to clean? This was the private room, which normally she had never entered unless invited. Here Jadis kept her accounts, typed her business letters, worked with her guitar, composed, or sometimes remained in profound silence, the door shut. Emily retreated. She sat down on the couch in the main room and thought about the things she had thought about ever since Jadis left. Which was, did Jadis mean to come back? There were 3 scenarios. First, that Jadis would be gone for a week, 10 days, a month, something like that, after which she would return and everything would resume as before. Secondly, that Jadis would return and explain to Emily that all was changed, and they must work something out, something that could be, of course, ultimately demoralizing and painful. The third possibility was that Jadis would simply call her and say, "I'm sorry, Emily, but I'm not coming back. Can you pack up my things and send them on?" It was really for this reason that, when Jadis had specified that she would telephone Emily every evening between 6 and 8, Emily had said, "Oh, no, you know I sometimes have to work late, and anyway, it will be difficult. Just phone me if you need anything." Jadis at once had said, "You're determined to make this as bloody for me as you can, aren't you?" Emily did not say, "You're making things very bloody for me." She did not even say, "Every time the phone goes, I shall feel sick with fear." She said, "I'm sure if it's as bad as it seems, you'll find it awkward to phone. Just call when it's over." Which terrible double meaning only struck her later, once she was alone. They had made love that night before Jadis went away. Jadis had been passionate and inventive, but Emily had had to pretend. Probably Jadis knew this, but they did not discuss it, or anything. In the morning they had gone quickly through the budget for the month. Jadis, a self-employed musician, tended to earn more, but not on a regular basis. Emily's job at the bookshop now provided the backbone for bills and rent. At 10, the taxi came, and Jadis, with a fleeting kiss, went immediately towards the door. Jadis, dark as a shadow, graceful as a lion, and Emily stood there in her drained whiteness, with her heart exploding, dry-eyed and smiling, not from pride, but from terror. When the door shut, and she had heard the sound of Jadis's light footfalls running down towards the street, the taxi starting, the wheels in the rain, Emily fell to her knees. After an hour pressed to the carpet, she saw the fluff had got tangled into it with the tempest of her tears, and so decided on the spring cleaning. They had met in the summer of the year before. It was one of those rare, hot, perfect European nights that imply one might be anywhere short of the equator. Up on the terrace garden of the bookshop, there was a publicity party with 2 quite well-known authors reading from their new books, bottles of cold wine, and an elegant buffet, complete with salmon and green seedless grapes. Emily had wanted to work in the bookshop for some while, ever since she had gone past it every day wretchedly on her way to somewhere not so nice. It was exquisitely clean, all glass and foot-deep plush, with escalators, a coffee bar, and best of all, stacks of books, the ancient and the modern, rising in tiers upon tiers, like a mountain built of words and dreams, life and fantasy. She had gone for her interview diffidently, but her instant mastery of the complex computer system, her knowledge of authors past, present, and in embryo, and her undoubted, mostly unconscious charm, saw her installed inside the week. She had been an employee only 2 months on the evening of the party. Emily had gone in the short black frock, with her blonde hair combed loose, not to entice, merely to be part of things. The 2 authors were a fat woman with a mane of black and gray curls, and a thin old man in glasses with a slight stammer. Both read superlatively well, and afterwards came together over the wine. Here it was soon apparent that they had fallen in love. Quite literally, that. For some reason they had never met before, and, as Emily discovered, they were both alone. Now their minds, bodies, and spirits flew to meet, and a wonderful bloom of excitement rayed out from them, making them as heady to be near as two teenage lovers. Emily could have laughed out loud in pleasure. It was a marriage made in heaven, her heavenly bookshop. Half an hour later, heaven provided some music, too. There was a childlike quality to Emily, completely unirritating since she knew nothing about it. She went lightly through the crowd and sat down on the clean paving, near enough to be able to watch the guitarist at her craft. What she did to draw the glorious alternating silver and contralto sounds from the instrument. At first, Emily was only dazzled by Jadis, who, of course, was entirely and defiantly dazzling. In innocence, Emily gazed on her, not thinking of herself at all. Jadis, Emily would have said, was a negress, a title which, like Jewess, has had so many awful connotations that, at one time, it would not be employed without grave and unforgivable offense. However, Emily would internally have reasoned, the basis of the word had such intrinsic power, the two images of essence black, negra, and she, the feminine ending, that for Emily, it came at once. Guileless, clad in splendor, and empty of anything banal, let alone criminally insulting. For Jadis was like an empress. She was the queen of the night. Her blackness was deep as the sea, and from the blackness flowered the two black eyes that had in them hints of Amontillado, even claret, and two crimson lips, the features of a fire god. Her hair was thick and woolen, and grown long in plaits, through which sequins were woven. She wore a white dress, cut low, and over that, a tight white waistcoat of silk, stitched with silver coins and stars. Emily had been in love before, and already the two authors, love was in the air, but oddly she did not recognize it. Even so, as she washed the hands of Jadis on the opulent body of the golden guitar, her blood began to tingle. It made itself known to her that the black girl made love to the instrument, and this was how the music came. And so at last, even in the last chords, it occurred to Emily's flesh, if not to Emily, the question as to how it would be if she were the guitar, so plucked and stroked, so coaxed by those sliding fingers with nails of mother-of-pearl, so quietened, so tantalized, so brought to a final aching cry. Emily got up. Her cheeks burned, and she took a gulp of wine. And then Jadis, smiling politely at the applause, glanced at her. Emily went forward, childishly, innocently. What might have been oppressive, even threatening in intent, was not from her. "That was so wonderful. I loved the Bach. And was it Rachmaninoff? And the last one?" "The last one was mine." "Oh," said Emily. It was as if she had seen her first Christmas tree, all bright with lights. And Jadis, it seemed, had the wit to know that here was genuine praise, the true response the profound artist deserves, and seldom receives, and then perhaps misunderstands, for it has come in the wrong dress. But there Emily was, white as a feather in her black frock, and there, black Jadis in her white gown. "May I get you some wine?" said Emily.
"Or I could share yours," said Jadis.
Emily gave her the glass. As Jadis's warm red lips touched the place where her own had been, the night blew up like a tent of fires, revealing all. But though the two authors, he smiling and she laughing, got into the same taxi and were borne away as if on wings, Jadis and Emily parted at the door of heaven, with only a lunch date for the following day. And after the lunch, at which Emily ate two mouthfuls of each course, and Jadis rather more, and they had opened two bottles of Pinot Noir, they parted again, with only that dangerous, flimsy thing between them, the number of a phone. However, Jadis rang Emily that night, just as the rosy sun was going down.
"Were you okay?"
"Oh, yes. What do you mean?"
"We had rather a lot to drink."
Emily vaguely remembered floating around the bookshop all afternoon, peculiarly expert with the computer, almost to the point of the psychic, and then how a faint depression came, about 5, and then the journey on the tube, and how the world had not seemed real, nor her room, and perhaps not herself now. Emily said she had been just fine. Jadis said, "I have to go up north tomorrow. A couple of bookings. I'm back next Saturday." Emily tried to grasp the notion of the city, empty of Jadis, therefore crumbling, falling, wrecked until Saturday came. Then Jadis suggested that they have dinner tonight. And Emily said, that was a very good idea. But it was her turn to pay for dinner, as Jadis had paid for lunch. And Jadis began to laugh.
"Why are you laughing?" asked Emily.
Jadis stopped laughing. She said Emily's name. And when she said this, Emily knew that never in the world before had there ever been a woman called Emily. The dinner was a foolish affair. They drank a little, but it was champagne. Ate one course, or Jadis ate it, and Emily inhaled it, toyed with it, left it in peace. A waiter arrived, it was a good restaurant, and asked if everything were quite all right.
"Quite all right," said Jadis. "But we're in love."
The waiter grinned. He seemed pleased with them. Never before had Emily heard anyone say anything so honest, and never again during the following months did she hear Jadis say anything of that kind or sort. Not even when, curled in Jadis's bed, among the sheets like fires, Jadis's skin upon hers, black smooth, curiously sandy, caressing at each shift in breath, revealing the strawberry of her mouth, her inner mouth, rose on ebony, her hair that could slap and sting and tickle and slide, her strength, her sureness, the rasp of her cry, the beating of her live heart. Not even then, not even after the song of Emily's orgasm, the stillness, the darkness, the dawn. Not then or after, the honesty, "I love you. I am in love with you, my love." As if said once, never again need it be said at all. And Emily could honor this. It was almost unique, like a comet. Once in a lifetime. Yes, that should be enough. In the morning, Jadis went north. A few weeks later, they began to live together, Emily moving into Jadis's flat. The area was better, and oddly it was easier to reach the bookshop from here. Jadis had explained she needed a little space of her own, a small physical space, to see to the boring bookwork of the self-employed, to practice and to compose. From that room came the patter of the old typewriter, the marvelous convolutions of the guitar. A phrase hummed. Curses. And affirmatives. Silence. Once or twice Emily knocked, to offer coffee or tea, to inquire in the first days what Jadis would like at the shops. These advances withered. Once in her chamber, the queen of the night was isolate. True, it was only an hour or so in the evening, a little more at weekends. And then, too, they would go walking, jointly shopping, to the cinema. And in the nights they would make love. "I love you," Emily wished to say. It is natural to the child, the loving child. But she was cautious. A cautious child. A well-mannered child. Of course, they talked a good deal of other things. Times, places, people. Even a little of past affairs. Emily had been hurt now and then, and though she never complained, it seemed to her that Jadis had not experienced hurt at all, had somehow avoided it, and did not refer to it ever because it was absent. This then gradually, as the day shortened, and the tube journeys became more neon and dull, formed an incoherent shape in Emily's mind. The shape, perhaps, of things to come. For if Jadis had never been hurt, Had she never loved enough to hurt, and therefore did she now?
They were new lovers still. Fires flamed in them, and they were companionable, and Emily was all admiration. The beauty of Jadis, her music, her independence. And Emily was so sweet. Yes. So she had been told by others.
We are in love. She wanted to say to Jadis in the black night that was her kingdom, do you love me still? Like some girl in a tight bodice from an old romance. But Emily did not want to offend, or engineer. She did not want to force a lie, or worse, a painful truth. Just before Christmas, Jadis was away for 4 days, a lucrative assignment for the guitar. Emily, left alone, was a model of fortitude. Although she could not sleep more than an hour or so each night, made mistakes on her friend the computer, broke a heel in the street, burnt out the kettle, and caught a cold. Every night when Jadis phoned her, Emily said nothing of all this, and was serene, loving, and encouraging. She bought Jadis an extra Christmas present, a long scarlet scarf shot with black and mauve. The evening when Emily came in, and Jadis was there, having caught an earlier train, some enormous tension seemed to let go of Emily's throat, and she burst out coughing for almost 5 minutes. In the new year, Jadis was away again, although only for 2 nights. Emily was much better at it now. She had even found some herbal stuff that helped her to sleep. In February, a letter came. Always, Jadis would verbally dismiss her letters. Some rude or importunate fan. Some tax demand. Now she said nothing, brooding over the single sheet of lined and tired-looking paper. "Are you all right?" Emily said at length. "Yes, it's this. I can't let you read it. It's very personal to her. A girl called Tina, someone I used to know." Emily for a moment felt as if far off, floating on a warm cloud of indifference, sorry only that Jadis had been annoyed. And then the little needle came, that pierced her like a burning wire. "Tina. Tina. I haven't seen the woman for years." Jadis poured herself another coffee and sat back, frowning. She had on her lion's face, lean and fierce. She explained that Tina had been someone she had met, briefly. She did not say what had taken place between them, but perhaps, probably, this was obvious. Now Tina was in dreadful trouble, of some unspecified kind, alone, distressed, reaching out. "I'll send her 50 quid, said Jadis. "It might help." Although up to a point they pooled resources, their earned money was their own. Emily had no idea that the donation might be wrong, and yet she did not like it. This sending of warm red notes to a secret woman called Tina. But she said nothing. They did not discuss it further. Presumably, the money went. In the next week or so, Emily found herself looking out for an envelope in that disjointed yet sloppy writing, the writing that had been on the envelope from the woman, Tina, the envelope Emily had pulled out of the waste bin. Nothing came. Nothing seemed changed. February passed and was gone. And in the dark, wet first Sunday of March, Emily and Jadis walked over the common in their boots. Emily stared about her. How bleak the trees before the buds, which were perhaps very late. And there a snowdrop crushed in the mud. There had been horrible frosts, and the early daffodils had died on the balcony. "What's up?" said Jadis. "You could be lost here," said Emily without thinking. "No, I couldn't." "Not you, then. Someone. I could. Lost and never found." "Let's walk over to the pub," said Jadis. "You're cold." In the pub they drank double whiskies and ginger, and there was a greyhound of the color of a bullet, gentle as a dove. The mood changed. Back in the flat waited muffins and butter, and lemons and cinnamon for the tea. But as they got in through the door, the telephone was ringing, and all at once Emily stood aside. Jadis answered the phone and said sharply, "Tina!" Emily felt all the air go out of her. Or was it her spirit? She became a flaccid skin dangling in the room. She went to the bed behind the screen, sat down and pulled off her boots and stayed still, listening. "Yes," Jadis said over and over again. That was all. Yes. Finally the receiver was put down. Emily came out and went to put on the kettle. It was as she buttered the muffins that Jadis came up into the kitchen and stood on the tiled floor and gazed at her. "Look, Emily," said Jadis, "I'm going to have to go off for a while. I don't mean an engagement to play. It's this girl, Tina. I have to. There isn't anyone else." "Isn't there?" said Emily. "No. I'm sorry. I can't break the confidence. It's foul. But I have to go. A week, a bit longer. Do you understand?" Emily thought she did not, but how could she? Or did she only understand entirely? She wanted to say, "Don't go. I don't want you to go." But that would be selfish and obtuse. She said, "No, of course." Later, during the evening, they talked about how it would all be managed, and Jada said that while away, she would phone, and Emily told her that it could be awkward. She had better not. And Jadis became angry, which was perhaps some sliver of guilt over Emily piercing her armor. That night, as Jadis slept silently in their bed, Emily lay awake as when Jadis had not been there. She thought, "I shan't sleep at all once she's gone." But this did not seem so very awful, only like a tiny scratch when a sword had already gone through her vitals. A few days after, Jadis left. She took a big cloth bag with her. She did not take the guitar. She wrote down a number where she might be reached, not apparently the number of the woman, Tina. Emily had had a long talk with herself, a long continuing talk through the sleepless nights as Jadis slumbered by her side, smelling of silk and sand, night and stars and blueberry soap, and distance. Emily had said, "You're being a fool. Tina is a friend. Jadis wants to help her. This makes Jadis just and kind." But Emily said to Emily, "Your time is done. Tina is the true love, the real love. Everything is over now." Emily knew that others had left her before and not come back, but Jadis was like no other. To consider that Jadis would really leave her forever was unthinkable. Emily could no more take it in than imagining that one day she would die. But one day she would. She would die. So why not this? Outside the door of the hidden chamber, Jadis's study or office or music room, Emily stood again with the silly excuse of the dusting camera brush in her grip. No, she did not want to tidy the room. That was not it at all. She wanted to go into it, as if she were going into Jadis, not merely the obvious loving and sexual things, tongues, fingers, but her whole body entering Jadis's skin, or brain, or soul. Emily was fully aware of this. She'd already done the things that lovers did in novels, pick up an armful of sweaters from Jadis's drawer and buried her face in them, gone to bed with Jadis's summer jacket, in a vain attempt to sleep. To go into the sanctum was somehow more finite. She opened the door and entered, closed the door at her back, and was shut in. Emily looked round. Of course she had seen the room before, sat in it on the other chair when Jadis had said, "Come and listen to this," playing over to her a fresh skein of music. How empty now, this room. It was a hollow shell. And though a dim memory of Jadis's perfume lingered, no real trace of her. The guitar stood free, breathing out of its case. The books on the shelves were in their usual orderly disarray. The typewriter had been covered against dust. Papers and leaflets, notepads and music paper and pens, littered the narrow table. Emily sighed, for there was nothing for her here, and against all common sense, she had thought there would be. She sighed and sighed and half turned to go out again, and as she did, she looked straight at the little cabinet in the corner by the window. In there, she knew, were kept the adjuncts to the guitar, strings like strange hair, rubs and cloths to beautify it. And also, for once Emily had seen one placed there, certain letters that Jadis wished to keep. Emily had a dreary thought, a thought that was hurtful and drab together. She was acting like a girl from a book. And was this because she had read so many books, and now could do no other? Could do no other than that which any heroine of any tale must now do. She walked over to the cabinet and opened it. It had no lock. And there, inside, was a pile of letters. With a grimace, a genuine spasm of her facial muscles, which might have been distaste or anxiety or shame, or simply thoughtless fear, Emily drew out this pale heap and put it on the floor. She stood looking at it. The first and topmost letter was not that which had arrived from Tina. It was a friendly note from an art center in Birmingham, thanking Jadis and asking if she would be free to come back in the summer next year. Emily considered. After all, the cabinet had no lock. What could be concealed in it? But then, Jadis would trust her. Emily had never had been so careful not to. Pride. The three scenarios ran swiftly through Emily's mind, like well-known playful rats. Jadis would come back. Jadis would come back and say, "Soon I will be gone forever." Jadis would call and say, "I am already gone." Emily made a noise. It was repressed, but hysterical. It mattered so much. Death was far away and could not be avoided, but this was life. This. She knelt down and knocked the pile of papers apart, and found at their bottom a stack of typed manuscript, or so it seemed, held together by a large clip. At first she thought that Jadis had written a short story, and felt a kind of wondering surprise, almost alarm, for it might not be very good. And had Jadis hidden it for this reason? And after all, she did not know Jadis well enough, though they had been together for months, to guess if she might be a good writer or not. And anyway, what did it matter? And besides, it was not a story, for now she released the clip and turned the pages. She found the unmistakable ending of a letter, here and there again. A friendly, loving letter, marked by something she herself had not used since childhood, in fact. Two kisses, written as X's, and beneath, sprawled bold and arrogant like ferns or flames. She penned the signature, Jadis. However, the top sheet did not begin like a letter. There was no introductory dear. There was no name. Oh, but it did begin. It did. It said, "My love." And next, below, it said, "I loved you since I was a child. I loved you how I loved you. And you never knew. Or did you know? But now I've looked into your eyes. Did you ever see? I wanted to make you see. I'll make you see." Emily sat back. Almost without thinking, she beheld a date typed efficiently at the top of the page. It was about 2 years ago. 2 years. And Jadis had said, had she not, "I haven't seen the woman for years." Although she then began to shake quite hard, Emily's brain seemed now to be crystal clear and cool as ice. She read the letter down. It was angry and impassioned. It hungered and did not expect to be filled. It ended, "But I've lost you. Well, not quite. You're here in my body, in my music." And then the two X's, or kisses, and the signature. Emily dropped the letter coldly and looked at the next. This was longer, and the date was now only a few days after she and Jadis had met. The time when Jadis had first gone away. The greeting was more empowered. The words cascaded and places run together. "And I held you, your body inked in on the sheet, the flowers of your breasts, and your vulva." Again Emily paused. inked in. Tina was black then. Emily felt herself shrink and sear. She was colorless and scrawny. Opposites had not attracted. Like wished for like. How horrible she must seem. Like a plant kept in the cellar and gone pallid. Unsucculent. And Jadis had known Tina since childhood. Jadis had given up until meeting her again. Again and again I made you catch fire from me. You blossomed against me like a river that ran uphill. Your opened mouth like a fruit so sweet, and the roar of your heart in my ear. I could hear your heart even as I lay against your thigh. I could feel your heart inside my tongue, like a drum. And your heart resounded even before you cried aloud, as if your body knew before you did. And it did.
I shouldn't read any more, said Emily. This is private.
She thought. There was no lock on the cabinet. She had been meant to find it all.
Oh, yes. A fourth scenario. How easy it would be for Jadis when she telephoned. For then Emily would say, prim, anemic Emily, the wilted daffodil, I know. Never come near me. I shall leave you. Goodbye. Or, not goodbye, which meant God be with you. No. She threw the letter away, far across the small room, and as it went, she saw three kisses on the end of the page. And the name. Or was it now only a word? Jadis. A word in a foreign language. Emily stood up. She opened the door, leaving it open, and went to the kitchen and took a bottle of red wine and opened that. She poured, not a glass of wine, but one of the newly burnished Coke glasses full. She drank, as if very thirsty, and went back to the letters of her lover to another. You are dark as the night, wrote Jadis to her love. I never found such darkness. I get lost in the cloud of it. I smother in your flesh and I die. I want to die with your hands on my body stretched out and howling, but I want to take you with me, and that's wrong. No, I want us to live. I want to make you come and build a cathedral out of your cries. I want to make a concerto of your cries. I want to curl up in your womb and you in mine. You're my child. I'm yours. I never loved anyone before. I wasn't alive. You frightened me. You're like a pillar, so smooth, impossible. Let me scale you. Let me pull you down. I want to cry, Emily thought, but I can't. Nasty, white, scrawny tears. How could she bear to touch me? There were no longer dates, but the letters were many. They had met in the city, obviously, by day, when Emily worked in the heavenly bookshop, poor little idiot, earning the steady income that had made everything so much more moneyed and more safe. But maybe Jadis had tried to give Tina up. Yes, that must be so, because here... I hurt so much. I want so much from you, and I can't seize it. I daren't even ask. I must make do with what I've got. Make do. She has made do with me. Emily felt a surge of rage. She screamed aloud. She tore the letter in her hands, across, and its wicked kisses. She broke them. Tina had given Jadis the letters back, evidently, and Jadis had put them away. But neither had been able to bear it, that making do. At last, Tina wrote to Jadis. Not a type orderly letter, but a sodden little scrap. How clever. How irresistibly vulnerable. Had £50 gone to Tina as a result? Or, more likely, another of those fires. This currency of the loins and heart. And so at last the telephone. And Jadis, with her face so weary, as perhaps she might one day look when she was very old, as now Emily would never see. I'm going to have to go away for a while. She had left everything. Even she had left the golden guitar. Jadis did not care. Love moves the sun and the other stars. Emily got up.
she had been impertinent enough to enter Bluebeard's chamber and found the secret, and now she would die. Emily stared myopically. Her Coke glass was empty. She must get more wine. Her life was empty. Another letter had fluttered up in her hand. She glanced at it. I will die of you. I could shake you, like the magic tree which you then let loose your fruits. I will have the curve of your stomach, the angle of your knee, the turn of your head, the chains of your hair, the soft gates of your mouth. But what else can I do with you? You strike me dumb, damn you. No, I want only the best for you. I wish I could eat you, from the soles of your feet to the crown of your head. But I only want to sit at your feet and sing. Four kisses. There were four. How curious, this affectionate token, the plaything of the casual pen. X's for kisses, after such an outcry. But now she was gone. She was with Tina. No more need for letters. Kisses to be implanted like burning spears. Emily let go the letter, let go of Jadis, and let go of her own self with them. For a few days more, Emily mocked time, as sometimes after a great shock it is necessary to do so, even with rescue in sight. Then she went one evening to the local surgery, at which she had registered all those months before. She knew what to say, for modern novels were full of it. There was a lot of stress at work, and she simply could not sleep. She understood she could be given a few sleeping pills, perhaps enough for 10 days, just to break the pattern of her insomnia. She did not want to resort to them, really, but she did need to sleep, or she could not cope. The doctor was sympathetic, demonstrably liking her general health, intelligence, and her resistance to the possible risk of addiction. He gave her 28 tablets, told her to take them for 2 weeks now, and keep the rest for future use, if necessary. He warned her that these pills were strong, and she should drink absolutely no alcohol while taking them. Emily promised that she would not, thanked him, and left. She was very relieved, because 28 pills, together with a bottle of wine, seemed certain to do what she wished. She had been afraid she would have to top up the medication with antihistamines or codeine, not sure of the result. The dusk was early, and Emily went through it like a shadow back to the flat. She had not said goodbye to the bookshop. Why should she think it had liked her? She checked carefully in the flat, as at the shop, that she had left everything pristine and in order. The slight washing up dried and put away, a stack of clean towels in the cupboard. Her own belongings had been placed in 2 cardboard boxes from the grocer's. There was no relative or friend who would want anything, need anything, but the items might bring pleasure somewhere. Emily had not bothered to make a will, but then she had no savings of any importance. She felt Jadis anyway would not want her money. It might seem callous or recriminating to leave it to her. The contents of Emily's wallet, 2 20-pound notes and a 10, she left on the coffee table, the 8 loose-pound coins she would need for the wine and her traveling expenses. Of course, Jadis would have to come back to the flat, but that again might be an advantage. Jadis might like to keep the flat for herself and Tina. She might in any case have had to ask Emily to vacate the premises, and that would have been awful for both of them. When Emily had finished, she drew the curtains back to let in daylight tomorrow for the plants. Outside, the laurel, full of rain, seemed bright as a jewel in the spring growth. Jadis would like the laurel and the bay trees. It was good to have left something lovely behind, in return for the lovely times. For the agony, there could be no return. It was too vast, and she could not hurt Jadis. Jadis was immune to her. Outside, there was only a faint drizzle now, and all the lights of the world seemed rolling and flashing through and into it. It appeared a cheerful evening, everyone going home to their hearths, or else rushing out to places of enjoyment. Emily looked about her sadly. She wished none of them any ill. The off-license was full of choice wine, and she bought a bottle of dark red, which the man assured her, although she had not asked, was a real winner for €5.92. She put it in her bag, which also contained the sleeping pills and the corkscrew she had bought yesterday. She had not wanted to take the corkscrew from the flat. Emily caught a bus, a red, wet bus, all lit with lights, and let it carry her up through the neons and the dark and the rain towards the common. People were talking and laughing on the bus, shaking themselves like wet dogs. There seemed a general mood of optimism and camaraderie. Even the driver, taking her fare, smiled at her, and Emily had smiled back. She thought how strange it was she felt no anger now, and very little pain. She did not feel desperate or tragic or even crucial. All had passed. This must be because she knew she would not have to suffer. Although once, it suddenly occurred to her, as if she had not realized it until then, "I am going to kill myself tonight." And she experienced a sort of startlement, as if she had just looked down and seen that she was floating several inches in the air. Even so, even though it must be unreal and curious, she knew it would happen. She did not want to change her mind. She never even thought to herself how much she loved Jadis to be driven out to do this. She did not see herself any more doing anything, really. She was no longer the heroine of her own story, who must be evaluated, psychoanalyzed. The heroine had ceased to exist. When they reached the edge of the common, Emily got out, and the bus hissed away from her, and its radiance was gone. She walked up into the woods. She took the path she had always taken Jadis, from force of habit. And since, in the dark, it was difficult to find a way, for the lights here were few and far between. So she came, after about half an hour, to the spot where she had said before that she could be lost. She recognized it, even in the dark, and, perhaps, had recognized it formerly, its possibilities. There was a steep dip where the trees clung close, and so a chance that if she went down into this part, no one would find her, or if they did, not for some while. She did not want to be found at all. She did not want to upset anyone. It was not their fault. She got into the dip easily, slid a little on the mud in last year's leaves, and so pushed through into the middle of the trees. Here she sat down. She felt like a child now, but it was not the charmingly unconscious childishness others perceived. This was a feral child, lost in the forest. She had not left a trail of beans or rice to follow home. Emily took out the bottle of winning wine and opened it with the corkscrew. She drank two mouthfuls, and all at once was apprehensive. She did not want the wine, and must consume the whole bottle. She should have brought water. But then, she could not have been sure. She would wait a minute, wait for the first mouthfuls to relax her. Above, through the rain-dropped boughs of the trees, she could see the drops of the stars. And on the branches, too, were visible other abrupt points, the spring buds finally beaking. Below, buses and cars rumbled. A plane threaded the night. She felt very calm. She drank another sip of the wine, save plenty for the pills. Yes, it was better now. How nice the wine was, after all. But she must get on. She had been here a long while, perhaps an hour. It seemed to have been an hour. Or even more. Time contracting, passing through another dimension, as sometimes it had done during the insomnia. The spaces between 1 and 6 a.m., lasting a month, were vanishing in a few minutes. Emily put her hand into the bag and touched the sleeping pills in her neat, flat box. And in that instant heard someone calling up the path, up from the road so far below. There was no need to worry about this. Emily must only stay still. The nocturnal traveler would go by. But the footsteps, a woman's it seemed, came striding, swift and harsh, over the debris of the path, right up to the dip. And then, as it might have done in a nightmare, a torch flashed down, straight into Emily's eyes, into her body, like a knife. "Emily!" shouted a hard and brutish and terrible voice. "Emily!" And Emily cowered, no longer feral, no longer calm, frightened to the brink of madness. She dropped the bottle in this state and heard it splash away its vital, needful fluid, and a tiny noise escaped her. Then the beast from above, with its eye of torch, came crashing down into the dip, tearing through the boughs of trees, kicking at the shale, growling and snarling. Emily jumped to her feet, but she could not run away. There was no room to do so. And now the beast, burning and roaring, took hold of her. The torch was clamped between them, and by its glare, Emily saw upward now into the lion face of night, which had formed itself into this shape and come to engulf her. Jadis! Jadis, furnace hot and smelling of feverish skin and perfume and the smoky taint of trains.
"What are you doing here?"
said Jadis, almost in her normal voice, just a little hoarse, breathless. "That's my question," said Emily remotely. Of all unreality, this was the most unreal. This could not be, and was not. Had she already taken the pills, and was she now hallucinating? Well, she could talk to the hallucination of Jadis. It was nice, really. She had not thought they would meet again. "Be grateful, then, Emily." "You look tired," said Emily. "Jadis." Jadis swung her a little, pushed her a little away, yet kept firm hold of her.
"What I'm doing here is finding you," said Jadis. "I saw you as you came out of the flat. I was across the road. I called to you, but you didn't hear. And so then I followed you."
"I didn't see you," said Emily. She was sleepy and wanted to lay her head against Jadis's breast. But obviously Jadis was not really there.
"No, I don't think you did. I stood outside the off-license," said Jadis. "And I waited for you to come out. Something was keeping me back, you see. You looked so bloody strange. I didn't want to scare you. And then I meant to speak to you as you came out again with that bottle of wine. I thought, somehow she knows I've come back, and the wine's to celebrate. Yes, that'd be good, but your face!"
Emily smiled. She did not know why. Jadis said,
"And when you came out, you looked straight through me. Do you know that? Straight through me, Emily. And you walked on. And then you caught a bus?"
"Yes, I did," said Emily. She amended, "but I didn't see you."
"I know you didn't. You bloody didn't. Christ, Emily. It was like... No, it was worse. It was much worse."
Emily said, "I read your letters, you see."
"What letters?"
"The letters you wrote to Tina."
"How could you read it?" said Jadis. "There was only one. I sent that."
"You mean you read it before I sent it?"
"The letter's in your cabinet," said Emily softly.
"I'm sorry. I know I shouldn't have. The letters that had kisses at the end."
"Kisses," said Jadis.
There was a silence. Emily said, "Were you on the bus?"
"The bus," said Jadis.
"No, I just stood there. And then I got a taxi."
"To follow the bus," said Emily.
"The bus was gone. I knew you were coming here."
"Yes," said Emily.
Jadis let her go. Jadis said, "When I first met you, you didn't see me. And you didn't tonight." Emily said, "I want to sleep now. Thank you for being with me. I did love you."
"You mean you loved me and now you don't love me?"
"Oh, yes," said Emily. "Always. And I hope you'll be happy with Tina."
"For God's sake," said Jadis. "I went to see Tina because her husband left her. I can't go into details. It isn't my secret, but she's okay now. She's with a man now. A man she likes. All right?"
"You loved her," said Emily, "since childhood."
"She wasn't even a friend," said Jadis with a terribly cold scorn. "But I owed her a favor, a big favor. I've paid it back now."
"But the letters were to Tina," said Emily.
"Those letters," said Jadis.
She drew in a breath. She put back her head, and Emily stared in wonder at the ebony column of her throat pulsing with life.
"No. Not Tina."
Emily laughed.
Her legs gave way gently as she dropped through Jadis's aura and sat on the muddy earth. It was so interesting, this. It was so mild. And soon she would sleep. And then she would die, going out with this memory.
"Listen to me," said Jadis, now beside her, shaking her. Jadis no longer burning with heat, but only warm, physically present, positive.
"What have you done? Have you taken something?"
"Yes, something nice."
"What?"
"All the sleeping pills. I don't remember, but I have, and the special wine."
"The wine's spilled,"
said Jadis. Her voice was like a sword.
"Give me your bag."
And Emily let Jadis take the bag, and out of it Jadis presently produced the packet of sleeping pills, intact, unopened.
"These. The seal isn't broken."
"It must be," said Emily. She was not alarmed.
"Was there anything else?"
"No, they should be enough, shouldn't they?"
"Maybe not, but you haven't had them."
"Oh," said Emily. Her brain began to rinse itself like a plate under a tap. Everything was sluicing off, and here she was, wide awake, cold, sitting next to Jadis under the trees. And Jadis was real.
"I've done everything wrong," said Emily.
"Get up," said Jadis. They rose.
"We'll go back to the flat," said Jadis.
"No," said Emily.
"I can't. Not now, not after the letters.
Shut up!" Jadis screamed at her. In amazement, Emily turned to see. Jadis's face was full of fearsome savagery. Her eyes were wide. She looked capable of killing Emily on the spot. Far away, a dog barked. It had heard the roar of the lion in the wood.
"Those letters," Jadis said.
She lowered her voice like a weapon.
"Those letters were to you."
"To me?" Emily asked politely. She was not going to die. She was not dreaming this. It was not mildness, but uncouth lies. Nevertheless, Jadis looked as if she'd been badly hurt, mauled perhaps by her own persona, turning. Emily said, "I've made an awful mess of this. I'm sorry. I'll just go down. It's all right."
"Emily, listen! The letters were to you! Things I couldn't say! So I wrote to you. It started years ago."
"How can it have?" asked Emily. She felt numb and temporarily quiet between onslaughts, as if after some successful minor surgery of which the outcome remained unsure.
"What do you mean?" said Jadis in turn. "How?"
"I remember the letters," said Emily. "You met her 2 years ago."
"I met you 2 years ago," said Jadis, her eyes flat as inverted stars.
"I met you in a restaurant, and you waited on my table. I tried to find a way to talk to you, but the place was full, and I was with two other stupid people. I went back, but you'd left."
Emily, surprised, said,
"Yes, I was a waitress. And you..."
"You didn't even see me," said Jadis. "And then you'd gone.
I wrote you the first letter then. I wrote you 3 songs, too. I thought you were gone for good."
"I did a lot of horrible jobs," said Emily vaguely. "I never stayed anywhere for long.
But how can I not have seen you?"
"You didn't. Have you ever?" Jadis said.
"You're all I see," said Emily. She lowered her eyes. Perhaps it did not matter if she told the truth at last, for what Jadis spoke could not be the truth at all.
"You don't see me," said Jadis. "You see skin and hair and eyes and bones."
She struck herself in the upper stomach hard. A blow.
"I'm here."
Emily flinched and frowned.
"I know. I see that you too. I wrote you the letters because I didn't dare say those things to you," said Jadis. "I didn't know what you'd do. So quiet and controlled and well-mannered and gentle. I could make you come. That was good. That was the only time the guard went down. But did you pretend? No, not with that heartbeat. That was real. So I wrote about that.
You said you loved me,
her.
Since you were a child, said Emily. She was abruptly defiant. She raised her head and stared into Jadis's face.
Even if I did meet you 2 years ago, how can I have known you as a child?
I didn't say you did, said Jadis.
I knew you.
I had a fantasy friend when I was little. I loved her. I told my sister and got a lot of shit because my secret friend was white and had blonde hair. I learned to shut my mouth. When I was about 15, I started looking for her. Emily, looking for you. And once or twice, I thought I'd found her. But I hadn't. And then I did. I did, Emily. Once. And you were gone. And then, that second time.
At the shop, said Emily. She considered how Jadis looked at her, and they had shared the wine. It was not like a first meeting. It was as if prearranged.
Fate, the second letter, said Emily harshly now, also lifting her voice up to meet the voice of Jadis's, so cruel and iron under her trees. Duelists.
That love letter!
To you, when I went away. After our first time. Another typewriter I borrowed for some business letters. The spacebar kept jamming. Emily said,
the words ran together.
That's why. Emily raised her fists now. She cried out.
You wrote her as inked in. Inked in. She's black. She's black, Jadis. You wrote it.
Jadis said, her voice falling back now through the air. A line drawing. Your whiteness on the darkness of the sheet. You seem to have a line drawn round you.
Dark as night, said Emily. That's what you said.
You are, said Jadis.
I don't mean skin. I mean the bloody cloud in you. The dark cloud that I can't get by.
But I love you, said Emily.
And you never said that you loved me.
Neither did you, said Jadis.
Why did you never tell me?
Why didn't you? Emily stepped back. She drew down her hands and folded them like a good child.
When I saw you at the shop, when you played your guitar, I thought you were the queen of the night. I'm sorry that I love your blackness. I don't mean to be insulting. I never even had a real friend who was black, but when I saw you, you were like a black torch, a black fire. All right, it's the outer casing and you're inside. But I love both. The look and the smell and the taste of you. Your eyes like the sky up there, but with red stars. Mars stars. And your hair that's so soft and so almost sticky and alive. And the paler, lovely line behind your ears. And the pink flush behind your knees. And your nails, and your palms, like the inside of a rose, a black rose, and your vagina there, flames in a coal, and how white your teeth are, and your eyelashes, and how your spine looks like a snake under your skin. And I love your music that you play in your room, and I love your music that you play in your room when I creep up and lean on the door to listen so I won't disturb you, and the way you listen to a book when you read it. Yes, I see you listening to the words, and the way you breathe when you sleep, and the thoughts behind your eyes, and all of you inside I love, all I know. But I've never known very much. You've never told me. And I want to be told. I wish I'd been there when you were a child. I'd have made them like me, even your sister, or I'd have made them put up with me. And we would have been together all the time we could. I never had a proper friend. I wish it had been you. I want to be with you now. I want to be with you when I'm old, and you're old. Some cranky old lady, thin and stooping, and graceful and bony, and your hair gray. And if there's anything when we die, I want to be with you then. For as long as there is. And forever, if there is forever. And if not, for now, at least that. Please. Emily undid her hands. She said,
Please.
Jada stood before her and was silent. Then at last she said,
Of course we'll live forever.
You only really want what you can have.
They went down the hill, not touching. And when they were at the bus stop, they began to brush the mud off each other, and made it worse. It looked as if they'd been coupling in the wood, rolling and biting and shrieking in a sexual frenzy. By the time the bus came, they were laughing so much that the driver grinned. Two pretty girls come from some office party. Well, live and let live.
In the dark, Emily sentimentally murmured, And the dear kisses on the letters.
Not kisses, said Jadis. The X's aren't kisses. They were the times I came.
Alone, the first time thinking of you. And then the times with you.
Like the marks on an airplane, said Emily. Shot down.
Little deaths, said Jadis.
5 tomorrow, said Emily, if you write to me.
To herself as Jadis slept, Emily mused dreamily on, and round, easing toward sleep as if across a smooth, deep pool. Emily thought,
The X's are not kisses. They are the unmarked and uncharted lands on a map. The map of the heart.
Yes, that's it.
And in those lands, we must always speak the heart's truth to be understood, whatever the cost. And if you speak this truth, and someone strikes you in the face for it, you must turn to the next one, the other cheek. Yes, you must, over and over, for one day it may not be a blow, but a kiss.
Alexandrians by Judas Garber. My mother gave parties, or they were soirees, cheap, shoddy soirees, and only gentlemen attended, though her maid served the drinks. I was 3, or maybe just 4. The maid bathed me angrily and washed my hair, getting soap in my eyes and hurting me. I was a nuisance. Sometimes, though, she was gentle in her way. Shushi, the name I called her, probably remembered wrongly. When gentle, Shushi would smother me to her bosom, cradle me, saying that I was a poor child, a poor neglected child. My mother, in moments of what she herself called tenderness, did something similar, but she touched less. She would put me back and stare at me, murmuring,
So pretty, what a pretty little boy.
So the poor child, the pretty little boy, learned early, as do we all, his nature and his names. We'd lived before in a crumbling tenement, and been saved from it to live in this other crumbling tenement, whose greenish walls decayed down into a river, which presumably was the Nile, or some offshoot of it. I had played in the mud sometimes with Arab children who found me unwholesome, too pale, and slow to learn. They'd jeer at, beat, or trick me. Now and then they drove me off completely, and I lurked at the corners, watching them. Their dirty, vibrant, solid world looked good to me, but I was already better fed, and I stank of being occasionally bathed. Miriam, my mother, always tried to stop me playing with Arab boys. Shushi, therefore, did the same. But mostly they didn't like me in the way. I spent a lot of time in my own room, which was narrow and damp. A tutor came at irregular intervals. Rather than teach me anything, he told me stories of his life. But I had no complaints. Everything different was of interest to me. Tonight's party, or soiree, for which I was being bathed, was apparently important. I was taken out of my room for important ones. I would make a brief appearance, or longer, if the guests showed approval. But my character often changed. I wasn't always Miriam's son, but sometimes the son of her sister, or an orphan boy she'd seen and bought, with French banknotes, from his destitute parents. Miriam came into my room at sunset, when the mystic cry was going up from the prayer towers. She wore a beaded coppery dress over her satiny amber skin. Miriam had a tendency to fat. She would eat nothing but sweetmeats if left to herself. And she liked cocktails, too. At other times she starved, taking only water. The general effect was voluptuous, very attractive and honeyed for certain men. She had a hooked nose, black eyes, black hair thickly curled. A salamander. Yes, that fits.
"How lovely," she said, looking at me.
"Judas, you're a little doll of a boy. Yes, you are. Made all of lacoum." Then, frowning, "What's that on his cheek?"
"A scratch," said Shushi. "Powder over it. Powder his face."
"You careless boy."
"He fell," said Shushi laconically. Actually, she had caught my cheek with the comb. She was always rough, even in her gentle hugs and rockings, which made one seasick.
"Never mind," said Miriam, dismissing not the scratch but my discomfort.
She stood looking at the rubber-red sun sinking behind moody water, dim domes, and cut-paper fronded palm trees. This marvelous view, for which a tourist might have committed murder, we rarely appreciated. She gulped her currant cocktail down and burped, an indulgence allowed only before us.
"Your dress is creased," she said to Shushi.
"Didn't you iron it?"
"Oh, yes," lied Shushi, who only ironed her hair.
There were three gentlemen that night. They sat in a half-circle round Miriam's divan. I sat on a stool to one side, fencing uneasily with a monkey one of the men had brought with him, his pet. It kept trying to bite me. Oh, familiar scenario. Everyone hated little Judas. I was frightened of the monkey, though the man had put us together at once, as if being both small, that should make us friends. He had also added slyly, "Watch, he doesn't bite you. Only me he never bites." Shushi clucked disapprovingly at the monkey. She equated all animals as vermin. Rats, cats, monkeys. Only animals that could be eaten were worth anything. She often praised to me a goat of her father's that was so very intelligent and had tasted delicious. The cocktails were sweet, reminiscent of kerosene. Sometimes Miriam made me taste one, or she gave me as a treat the cherry from her drink. When I was two, she slapped me before her guests for gagging and crying at the burn of the alcohol. Someone quipped I had been born an abstainer. Was it after that party Miriam tried to lose me in the city? Maybe not. Anyway, it happened many times. She would drink heavily, and next day a madness of depression set in. She would then lead me out, her eyes leaden, looking like what at first she must have been, an inexpensive whore of the alleys. In the midst of a busy street, she told me to wait, by a Jewish shop. Then she went away. An hour later, the old Jew came out and found me there. "You expect now, I'll tell you, he was kind, gave me a cup of milk and bore me home to my unwilling mother. But oh no. He drove me off, lashing with his arms, cursing me in Hebrew. I then spent some hours roaming about. I think I cried, but can't remember. I should have been swept away, grabbed for some brothel, or simply killed in passing by someone or other. Instead, by peculiar accident, I finally saw Shushi, creeping back to the flat from some villainy, and running up, grasped hold of her skirt. "You!" she exclaimed. "She won't like you being here." And home we went. Miriam, when she woke from her drugged sleep, seemed to have forgotten everything. But afterwards, like the children in fairy tales, I memorized landmarks on every outing, and now and then found I'd needed to. Twice she left me in the same cafe. I stayed until midnight when I was put out, both times to clear the place for a band of robbers. The apartment doors were locked when I got back, and no one would let me in until dawn, when the sweeper came. It was a sort of amnesia with Miriam. She forgot me, and then forgot she had forgotten me. One of her men asked her one day, night, why she gave me this doomed Christian name. She shrugged. She had some ridiculous reason, but really she had forgotten who Judas was supposed to be.
In the end, the monkey noticed something moving behind the cabinet. No doubt a rat. The large black kind from the building. The monkey stole away, and I was able to relax a little. It was then I saw one of that night's beaux was watching me. When he saw me looking, he smiled, but I didn't smile back. I knew no one was to be trusted, that I was pretty, neglected, and quite unlikable. If they hated me, and tried to pretend the opposite in order to trick me, why help them? Presently he put the smile out and glanced away. Soon after this, my mother asked me to recite a poem the tutor had, in a moment of aberration, taught me. I saw all the faces in the room but hers set in a ghastly rigor. The reciting child. Quickly I shuffled the verses in my head, selected one that was short, and said it clearly, putting in the commas, as my tutor had expressed it. Alexandra Thévaux. It took 1 minute. I was applauded, obviously, for being so quick. Miriam looked disappointed.
No, no, there was more. About the horse. You've left it out.
He did very well, madame, said the man who had smiled at me. But I, too, know this poem. Bousfalon, with his eyes of blackest flame, the ox star on his brow, that Alexander loved more than his lover, who never bore him with that pride, not truly knowing him to be a god.
"And the boy's been taught that?" asked the fat man with the monkey. "No wonder he left it out."
From behind the cabinet came screeches. The monkey had met the rat, and probably they had both bitten each other. Everyone jumped up, my mother screaming, the fat man in great fear for his pet. I found myself left behind with the man who had smiled, as the others scrabbled at the cabinet, hefting it so things inside fell over with a crash, coaxing and shouting. He said quietly to me, "Do you understand the poem?" Under all circumstances I must be polite, but I need not smile. I said, "Alexander loved him, but only the horse loved Alexander as he should be loved." "Loved whom?" asked the man, who was old and straight and smelled clean and fragrant, by which I mean he seemed all that. Then he was probably about 26. The fat man had brought him with the monkey. "Loved," I stumbled on the Greek name, "Lucestion." "Does that seem strange to you?" asked the old young man. I was silent. "No, it didn't seem strange. I hadn't thought about it." "For a man," he said, "to love another man in that way."
"What way?"
"Who cared?"
He said, "I'll teach you 2 new words. A woman who loves another woman is called for an island, Lesbos, a lesbian. But a man who loves another man is called for Alexander, who was the son of a god and loved men, and for his city by the sea, Alexandria, an Alexandrian." He touched my head softly. His hand was cool in the hot, cocktail-fumy night, and he cool and calm, keeping us beyond the noise and upheaval, the monkey business at the cabinet. "Will you be an Alexandrian, Judas?" I glanced up at him then. His face was intent, actually innocent. Do, I mean, naive. "I'd like," he said, "to take you to a courtyard that has a beautiful green cistern and lamps that shine in the water, but you're much too young." And he'd kill me. He likes women too, you see, but we must all be faithful. Can you imagine it for me? One night, Judas, sitting by the green pool with me, je te veux. By the time you're ready, I'll be old. It took me by surprise. I didn't know one could fall in love at sight and with a child. "Will you tell her this, what I've said, your mother?" "Please, don't. I don't trust your mother. She might bring you to me." "Don't. Whatever you do, don't tell her."
From his hand resting on my hair, a wave of tingling newness poured all through me. I wanted to fall down asleep or otherwise unconscious at his feet, have him pick me up, myself boneless, take me to the courtyard with the pool. There we would be, and do what? Flickerings moved in my belly. Something stirred. A snake. Then I felt very sick, and ran quickly out of the room, to the place with the bucket, where I threw up violently. Shushi would curse me when she found it. My sick in her bucket. One more mess. No one, but for him, presumably, noticed I didn't come back. The monkey was extricated and taken at once away. Glasses had been smashed. The party also broke up in confusion, and my mother drank herself into a stupor, and late the next day, took me out to lose me somewhere. It was Shushi who found me in the bazaar, with the lights strung up on wires, and naphtha torches. She'd been looking for me. It was I who'd dawdled. Although I never saw him again, for years I would lie in bed, and think of the cistern, and the man's hand on me, riven with glorious swirling excitements, tingles and surges that seemed to have no beginning and could bring no end, but which at last drew the snake upright on its rosy stem. I must have been 7 by then, and reached out to hold the snake, knew in stages that he too took me somewhere, and went with him, and arrived, and was lost. But you still come back. That's the problem with it.
Death and the Maiden by Esther Garber. 1. Saint John Blaise was famous as a skilled romantic painter, somewhat affiliated to the pre-Raphaelite school, and also for many rumored exploits, one of these being that he tended to mix up his more complex colors on the back and back side of the latest nude model, using her as a palette. Ruth met Blaise's wife by chance at a charity event in London.
"Oh, there's Lady Vera Blaise."
"Vera?" asked Ruth.
"It's a Russian name. She has Russian blood, I believe. Isn't that superb? And so suitable, as she's married to Saint John Blaise."
Ruth had been press-ganged into assisting at a stall that sold beads and ribbons. She wondered how this had happened, some stillborn promise to a friend who hadn't understood how to take yes as the true answer of no. After the first 20 minutes of playing with the colors of the ribbons, Ruth had grown leaden and bored. She was also growing into the floor of the large room, with its fake palms and slow-moving crowds, dying of yawning. But now here was Melisande Crabtree, chattering as usual in her cage-bird way. Melisande, anything less like, poor thing with her long red nose and frantic crooked hat. But these archaic names were all the fashion now. Lord Tennyson's poetry and the sumptuous work of the pre-Raphaelites had seen to that.
"Look!" cried Melisande, her nose blushing more deeply. "She's coming this way!"
Ruth raised her heavy head, and boredom and ennui fell from her with a resounding crash. Vera Blaise was a tall, broad-shouldered, elegant woman. She wore a costume of midnight blue, simple as only wealth allowed. Her dark hair, piled up in coils under her wide hat, framed a strong face of high Slavic cheekbones and slanting golden cat-like eyes. She moved in on their stall with the striding walk of a woman more used to horse-riding and, you suspected, trousers in the freedom of her own home.
"Oh, good morning, Lady Vera!"
stammeringly twittered Melisande. "Hello, Melly, how are you? Good," said Vera Blaise, dismissing Melisande with absolute politeness.
"Look at me," thought Ruth. "No, you won't."
New-made aristocrats were always the worst, and after all, Blaise had only been knighted last year. Vera leaned forward a little and ran some of the ribbons through her fingers,
dismissed them also, picked up a long strand of sea-green beads.
"Remind me," she said to Melisande, "what this is all about."
"The charity we're supporting? Oh, it's Northern Orphans, Lady Vera."
"Indeed, is it? Are there many?"
"Oh, yes, Lady Vera. The mining disaster at—"
"Yes, I remember. You'll think me callous," she added, turning abruptly her amazing tiger eyes full blast on Ruth, who felt herself inwardly sway at the impact. "But I attend such quantities of these things." She held out her hand, immaculately gloved, and Ruth shook it. Even the glove was electric, of course.
"Blaze," said the tiger. "Vera."
"And you?"
"Ruth Isles."
"Miss Isles, I believe I'll take some of these beads. My daughter would like them, at least I hope so."
"You have a daughter, Lady Vera?" Ruth asked, bemused.
"Yes, a young girl, about your age, I suppose. But then, not so young that it means I am young any more."
"Oh, Lady Vera!" cried poor Millicent flirtatiously, but excluded to the outer reaches of the stall that were now about 100 miles away.
Ruth said, "I'm not so young either, Lady Vera."
"Do drop the lady. It's tiresome. He dislikes it, too," she added with an unmistakable offhand contempt. "He wanted it so much, that rap on the shoulder by a sword. But Sir St. John sounds quite stupid, don't you think?"
Melisande bubbled with shock. Ruth grinned.
"Melly," said Vera, turning back to her gracious and certain, a fine commander giving perfectly reasonable orders, "you take over this stall, will you?"
"Oh, but, Lady Vera—"
"Parcel up all those beads for me, there's a dear. Here, a pair of guineas."
"But, Lady Vera, that's too much for those orphans of yours, and I'll just borrow Miss Isles a moment. I really must have someone show me where the tea-room is."
Ruth found herself plucked instantly away, swimming strongly through the currents of meandering ladies, side by side with Vera Blaze. Melisande was left behind, an astounded shipwreck among the guineas and the beads. They drank tea at a table under a tall window with a view of the self-absorbed city rushing by below, carriages, horses, and people.
"Northern Orphans," mused Vera Blaze. "That, if abbreviated to its first letters, unfortunately spells no.
Not an augur, I trust?" She had removed her gloves to reveal wonderful practical hands, scarred across the fingers and palms by either hard gardening or horse pursuits, or both. Ruth noted the golden wedding ring, broad and engraved by some classical design, also a tawny polished stone worn on the right hand. They had not talked about art. Ruth, who had no interest at all in St. John Blaze or his paintings, had sensed she was not now alone in that. Vera's conversation concerned the state of London architecture, politics, briefly, and a ludicrous soiree she had been to the night before. She made Ruth laugh at every juncture. Vera's awareness of the absurd seemed finely tuned. Then,
"How I long to go home," she announced. "London is always itself, but the countryside, even my countryside, so close to the city, is never the same 2 days running. Also, I can smoke at home after my cup of tea. I have a brand of cigars made especially for me in the South Americas. Delicious. I wonder if you'd like them."
Ruth said, "If you did, I'm sure I would."
"What an obedient girl you are."
"I only follow those worth following," said Ruth, recklessly perhaps. But Vera Blaze merely said, "One prays your judgment, then, is never faulty."
"Often," said Ruth, "but sometimes true excellence is so overwhelming even I can't miss it."
Vera turned and again looked straight into Ruth's eyes, dazzling her.
"The young go so fast," she said. "Like a runaway train," said Ruth. "Malleable, salty, tasty."
"Well," said Vera,
"perhaps I should take you home with me." Ruth's heart bounded to a stop and fell over, panting, on the floor of her ribs.
"How pale you've got, Miss Isles, or shall I call you Ruth? Now is that surprise or pure horror?"
Ruth shook her head. She felt foolish and gulped the last of her tea. The pleasant high of the leaves revived her enough to hear Vera Blaze amend. "No, I don't mean the townhouse. Park Row is such a bore. I was thinking of the country place, Blaze House, at Steepacre. It's not 12 miles from St. Paul's, so I think somebody once estimated. He's off, by the way. Off in Italy with one or two of his more recent mistresses. How lovely. Why don't you pop back to your rooms and pick up what you want for a week or so? I suppose you're free for a week or so?"
"Splendid. Give me your address, and I'll send round the carriage in about 2 hours."
Ruth realized that, having given the address, her lips remained parted, probably to speak thanks or utter a scream of bewildered joy. Instead, she must have, she later thought, sat there like a fish in water as Vera Blaze rose to her impressive height and stalked, smiling, away. "Well, she's nearly killed me, all right. Now I'll just creep off to my thicket until she sends her carriage for me and carries me to her lair." Ruth entertained a vision of a slow devouring by a gold-eyed lioness. Rather than creep back to her room, she sprang through the streets, as fast as her corset and the omnibus would allow. Steepacre, when Ruth reached it in the yellow late afternoon light, was steep. Everything flowed up or downhill, fields in the first process of producing some sort of grain, corn, wheat, hedgerows growing in some places to great heights against the thickets of oak trees and coppices of beech. A large village straddled the road with a hump-backed bridge that looked too elderly to be English and was probably Roman. Then the lane showed, through a froth of browning May blossom, the gateposts and the drive. Blaze House rose from its park, with an oddly suburban mock-eastern look. Doorway pillared rather like that of a Hawksmoor church, a little dome balanced above the central roof. For the first time in half an hour, Ruth recalled the city lay, its most bricked and depressing outskirts just over a rise. Laurels flanked the door. A huge brown dog with the head of the Anubis jackal god of Egypt emerged from nowhere and stood staring as the coachman unloaded Ruth's bag. Vera herself had not accompanied Ruth to the house. Apparently she had been delayed and would arrive later and by other means. Nervous already, Ruth had been made less and more nervous by Vera's non-appearance. Now the dog compounded her unease.
"He's all right, miss," said a footman in rather slovenly clothing, emerging also from the front door. "He won't do you no harm."
"Really?"
"No. Soppy as a duck he is."
Ruth believed that ducks could be quite dangerous if roused, but she walked behind the footman and the bag into the house, and when the dog padded in after them, asked,
"What's his name?"
"Bacchus," said the footman.
After a pause, he added,
"They all get daft names here."
"All?"
Ruth had been pondering who else was present in Blaze's absence. The footman, though, only replied that someone would come presently, and then carried off the bag in the upsetting way of such things. The dog, meanwhile, stood staring again at Ruth.
"Bacchus?
Here, Bacchus,"
said Ruth, in a firmly courteous voice.
Bacchus turned instantly and trotted away. The hallway was now what took all Ruth's attention. It was coolly tiled throughout, in an eastern manner, green lotuses in blue and turquoise images of peacocks with gilded tails, a circle of thin pillars needled up to support the roof of the dome 2 stories above,
in which slits of colored glass stained slivers of lights like lemons, jade, and raspberry jam. A fountain trickled into a square pool of goldfish. Of course, it was St. John Blaze who had designed the house. Like one of his most luxurious paintings. Some eastern domicile of odalisks. And he called his dog Bacchus, and chose his wife for her Russian blood and Russian name. He had never, Ruth thought, painted her, or Ruth might never have seen if he had, having never much noticed his paintings even when they were photographed for periodicals. A housekeeper came and conducted Ruth upstairs, with gilt handrails that showed spread fans or gazelle hunts, and led to whitewashed corridors and pointed windows covered by lattices of wood that let through only countless diamonds of light. The room Ruth had been given was also whitewashed, but with a huge plume velvet bed and scarlet settee flung with sequined cushions. An oriental lamp hung down from the ceiling, with a geranium boldly growing in it. "What on earth am I to do here?" Ruth thought. But there was also a bathroom, and hot water available. She took a bath and dressed herself in her white evening frock. Outside by then, the long yellow afternoon had burned into dark gold. The sun set in a field beyond the tumbling park, catching several woods alight as it fell. When Ruth exited from her bedroom doorway, she found herself reflected in a mirror, but the wrong way round. She saw herself from the back. A startling view. The long white gown, bare shoulders, fair hair scooped up and some left drifting over the neck. No, it wasn't a mirror, but one more tiled annex. And there inside another girl, in a white frock, standing gazing out of one of the diamond holes of a lattice. Who was she? Ruth hesitated, but then from below she heard the unmistakable voice of Vera Blaze, calling in amused exasperation. "Bacchus, here you beast, good boy! There, your best muddy paws on my skirt! What a good fellow you are!" Ruth hurried along the passage, like her dog, Ruth thought, now hurrying down the stairs. Just like a dog. Desire, let alone sexual love, disorientates. You might be in the most familiar spot in the world, and if the object of fascination also happens to be there, everything else becomes not only unfamiliar, but intangible, oblique. For this reason, not that of clumsiness or nerves, you drop the well-known cup on the carpet, or stub your toe on the doorframe you have successfully negotiated 9,022 times previously. Love is a reinventor. So now it didn't matter, did it, being in this strange rich man's house, all set about by Moorish tiles and feverish trees, with jackal dogs and backwards seen mirrored girls. All that mattered was, "Have a glass of this fruit brandy, Ruth. What a journey. You'd think it would be quite easy, but no. What a fuss they make, men. On and on, poor chap. He's only 23 and acts like some granny in Kiev. Oh, we must do this as this. Oh, we must never allow that and that." It seemed a local neighbor had wanted her to ride down with him in his carriage. Vera had obliged. "He hopes one day he'll manage an affair with me," she added. "My God, the self-delusion! And I'm old enough besides to be his sister." Vera was resplendent, having changed into a white silk blouse and burgundy waistcoat over, almost as predicted, loose Turkish trousers. She had also taken down her hair, which ran in dark waters along her back. She smoked one of the cigars, perfuming the Chinese drawing-room, while Bacchus of the Latin name lay like a sphinx at her feet. No one else seemed likely ever to come in. Ruth didn't quite dare to say, "Are we alone here?" As well. Next moment an intruder entered. That was not a servant, who might be expected to come and go. Worse, Vera greeted the intruder with a warmed and softened expression and holding out her hand. The girl, she was the white-dressed one from the upstairs annex, moved forward slowly. Ruth felt a flash of deep dismay. Then Vera said, "Darling, here's a young lady I made friends with in London. Ruth, let me introduce you to my daughter, Emerald.
Emerald, said Ruth. She heard the disapproval in her own voice, and quickly getting up, nodded to Vera's daughter. Miss Blaze, the girl who Vera was now encircling with an arm, so delicately you could see it was a very cautious embrace, turned and looked at Ruth. No, they were not, Ruth thought, at all alike. Neither she and the girl she had taken for a reflection, nor Vera and the girl who was her child. It wasn't fair hair she had. Noted in full light, it was like rusty gold. She had a pale, exquisite face, modeled maybe from clearest marble. Only her blue-green eyes at all resembled her mother's, in their long, oval, upward slanting. And yet, Emerald. He must have named her, like the dog. Even so, she was well-named, for her eyes were exactly like that. Two beautiful, fabulous stones.
Good evening, said Emerald. She sounded like a mechanical doll.
Someone, Vera by some lightest touch, had turned the little key in her back, and now the girl came to life and spoke. Ruth felt horribly compelled, more by curiosity and actual aversion than anything else. She crossed the room and held out her hand for Emerald to take and shake a little, in the fashion among worldly women. But Emerald didn't take Ruth's hand.
"My name is Ruth," repeated Ruth.
"I hope I find you well."
"No," Emerald said at once. "I'm never well. Am I, Mother? Father knows I never am."
"Nonsense," said Vera, but she said it quietly, with a studied, playful call.